Before I just get into what I want to share this morning, I had a conversation with Jen yesterday and thought we should talk etymology a little bit here this morning. So we've been using this term Jehovah, and maybe you're unaware of sort of where that comes from. In the Hebrew Bible, when you come across the personal name of God, it's Yahweh or something, some pronunciation like that. We're actually not completely sure. But back when the Bible was written, there were only consonants. And so as the Masoretes added vowels in, because you weren't allowed to say the personal name of God, they actually added vowels for a different word, Adonai, Lord. So you come to this word, and it's got the consonants of Yahweh, it's got the vowels of Adonai, and it's supposed to remind you, don't say Yahweh, say Adonai. And since I'm an Old Testament student, I've kind of gotten in the habit of saying Adonai whenever I come across that in the Hebrew Bible. But then if you try and actually pronounce that mashup of consonants and vowels of two different words, it comes out to something like Yehovah, from which then over time became Jehovah. So I say that simply to say, I know we've often used that word Jehovah. I'm in such a habit of saying Adonai that I'm going to do it again today as I speak. Don't think that Jen and I are having a fight. We're actually using two words that are both pointing to another different word, which is the personal name of God. So when you hear me say Adonai, it's the same thing as when Jen's saying Jehovah, just sounds a little bit differently. You don't have to get your ears checked. And no, we're not fighting. Jen mentioned that I was going to chat about a trip I took. Back in 2010, some of you know, I got to take what I consider sort of, to this point in my life anyways, the trip of my lifetime. Participating in an archaeological dig in Jordan. Now, as incredible as this experience was for me, I recall it getting off to a bit of a rocky start. Now, by nature, I'm not really the sort of spontaneously adventurous type. I kind of like having things organized. I like details being thought through. I like being as prepared as I can be for something. For this particular trip, I had never met any of the other people I'd be working with. I wasn't traveling with any of them. I was only going to be meeting up with them when we got in country, which was fine because I knew how to get on an airplane, and as long as I got on the right airplanes, I'd get there, and then we'd meet up, and away we'd go. So I remember touching down at Queen Aliyah Airport in Jordan, in Amman, late at night. I think it was 9:30 or 10. It was dark. I paid for my visa, I grabbed my luggage, I went through customs, and then headed out to the arrivals area where I was very, very certain arrangements had been made for someone to meet me and pick me up and get me to the hotel. And so I looked around for someone, you know, holding a sign with my name on it, or a sign with the name of our dig on it, or just someone looking like Indiana Jones. I mean, I would have taken any of those things. But as I looked around, I didn't see any of that. So I kind of nervously wandered outside. Maybe they're waiting outside for me in the car. Nothing. No luck. Now I was getting nervous. I was getting anxious. I had no idea what I was doing. I was in a country I'd never been in before. They speak a language I don't speak. So I managed to find a visitor info center, got them to patch me through to the hotel by phone. I asked to speak. I knew the name of one person on the team. I asked them to put me through to that room, and thank the Lord, quite literally, that person was in their room and picked up the phone. I wasn't terribly amused when very in a kind of unfazed manner. You know, they didn't seem fazed by the fact that they'd forgotten to send a driver for me. So they just, well, why don't you just go outside, grab a cab, and come to the hotel? So I did that. I went outside. I managed to communicate with one cab driver who then stuffed me in someone else's cab. And the next thing I knew, I was heading away from the airport, and then I was leaving the city limits, and then I was driving out in the pitch-black countryside, somewhere outside of Amman. I had no idea how long my trip was supposed to take to the hotel. It ended up being about an hour or so, including a stop at a military checkpoint with what looked like a 17-year-old kid with an assault rifle vetting me. So no cell phone, no GPS, language barrier. I had no idea if we were going the right direction. I had no idea if they would ever locate my body. I did not know what was happening. In spite of my misgivings, I eventually arrived at the right hotel in one piece and had an incredible 2 weeks in Jordan. But I can tell you for certain, I remember quite clearly, arriving at the airport in Amman, halfway around the world, and discovering I was alone. I was on my own, no one there waiting for me. That was kind of disconcerting for me for a little bit. That experience came to my mind as I was thinking about the Israelites in the text that we're going to look at very briefly today. As the Israelites are on the verge of stepping into a future in which, I think as we read the story, they're wondering whether God is going to be there. Would he actually be present and ready to guide them on the next stage of their journey? Or were they going to step into their future and discover God wasn't there anymore? He had left them alone. Here's how our story has gone so far in this series. Having been brought out of slavery in Egypt by God, the people have arrived at Mount Sinai. Moses heads up the mountain where God gives him tablets with the law written on them. Now, while he's up there, there's a fairly extensive conversation that goes on between God and Moses, and a lot of that conversation is God giving these detailed commands and instructions about building this tabernacle, this portable tent that God intended would be his home with the people. So Moses then climbs down the mountain, only to find that while he's been gone, the people have made a golden calf and they're worshiping it. I mean, they are engaged in full-on idolatry. God's not happy. People die. This is not a good scene. And yet, in his grace and compassion, God eventually calls Moses back up the mountain, where he's given a second copy of the tablets that he had broken. And there's a few verses. When Moses is up on the mountain, there's a few verses, not as much, but that talk about this conversation between God and Moses. They have a chat again, but not a word is recorded about the tabernacle. Given how much God talked about it the first time around, you'd think it would come up, but it doesn't. God is like radio silent on the topic. Same goes for God's promise that his presence would dwell in the tabernacle. God says that explicitly two times, but both are before the whole golden calf debacle. Now, regardless of God's unsettling silence on the topic, Moses directs the people to go ahead with the instructions he had gotten earlier and build this tabernacle. And they carefully, you know, their careful obedience in doing that, in constructing all the pieces, takes up about 4 or 5 chapters towards the end of Exodus. Now, if you can somehow suspend your knowledge of how the story ends, if you could kind of wipe that from your memory, I think the process of the people building the tabernacle is supposed to raise suspense for us as readers. What does God think about this project now? Is he even interested in the tabernacle anymore after the people's blatant unfaithfulness to him? I mean, they can build it. In fact, they are building it. But will he come? Or will they, you know, so to speak, get off the plane after a long journey only to find themselves standing in the arrivals area alone? God not waiting for them there. God not present to them. And I wonder how many of us can relate to that feeling, looking to the horizon of our own lives and wondering if God will really be there with us. I wonder how many of us question whether or not our mistakes, whether or not our sin has just messed that up. We've pushed God to the edge and now he's about to throw the towel in. Our failure has been too much and God's just moving on. In the book of Ezekiel, the prophet describes the way in which the people of Judah have found themselves in this kind of predicament. They've committed idolatry. There are indictments by God against the king, against the prophets. Jerusalem as a city is singled out for how messed up things are. And the whole thing results in the people finding themselves being relocated by a foreign king, and now Babylon is their new home. And I imagine them sitting there in exile, pondering how badly they've messed up, wondering if maybe it's just all over. Was God finished with them? Was there any reason to look to the future with hope? And it's in this context that the name of God that we've been introduced to today appears in the Bible. You see, for as poorly as the book begins, Ezekiel's prophecy turns the corner to hope by the end. It ends with a restored land, a restored temple, and a restored city of Jerusalem. And most importantly, it ends with an unmistakable statement about God's presence. Literally, the very last words of the book of Ezekiel, speaking about Jerusalem, says this. It says, "And the name of the city from that time on will be Adonai Shema, the Lord is there." For as badly as the people had messed up, God assured them that his presence, that his restoring presence, would absolutely be part of their story. They weren't in danger of arriving at the airport and finding no one there. Adonai Shema, the Lord would be there. Back to our merry band of wilderness wanderers in Exodus. You know, all the pieces of the tabernacle project are now finished. And the big question is about to be answered. Will God show up? Can they be forgiven? Having turned their hearts back to God and faithfully constructed the tabernacle, will he choose to be there with them, or has their sin been too great? Will the cloud of his presence, which it seems is still kind of hanging out there in the sky somewhere, will it just sort of stay there, maintaining a healthy distance from the people? Or will it even depart from them? Or will it settle in their midst? At the beginning of chapter 40, the last chapter of Exodus, God finally says something about the tabernacle. Finally. He basically says this to Moses. He says, "Okay, pieces are all done. Why don't you set it up? Set it up." And I sense the anticipation just ratcheting up. Is God intending to make a statement about what he thinks of the people by having them set up the tabernacle and then turning his back and just moving away? Or does he plan to take up residence with them? There's only one way to find out. So the people assemble all the pieces that they've carefully constructed, and then they step back. What's going to happen? And what happens is God's unmistakable answer. "Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." In all the travels of the Israelites, whenever the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle, they would set out. But if the cloud did not lift, they did not set out until the day it lifted. So the cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, in the sight of all the Israelites during all their travels. God chooses to be present to his people. So tangibly present, in fact, that Moses can't even get into the tent. It's so thick, God's presence. And it's not just that God is present, but I think like in Ezekiel, this is God's restorative presence. It's a presence that says to the people that in spite of their failings, God is still absolutely committed to them, still loves them, is still with them. He is unmistakably there. And now they can step into the future with confidence about God's presence and God's posture towards them. Adonai Shema, the Lord is there, points us to the truth of God's restorative presence with his people. It's, I think, a great message of assurance and hope for all of us, but I wonder maybe if today it speaks loudest to those of us who may at times have an unhealthy orientation towards our past. Those who too long have carried the burden of wrongs done, of sins committed. Wondering if we've irreparably damaged our relationship with God. It's a message for those of us who have no problem saying, yes, God's grace is enough for everyone else in this room. And we're just not sure if it's enough for our own lives. Enough to cover what I've done. It's a message for those who wonder if we've simply become a disappointment to God and he's moving on. Adonai Shema, the Lord is there, is the message that God's restorative presence is absolutely for your life. It was enough to cover, to overcome the blatant idolatry of the Israelites at Mount Sinai. It was enough to overcome the complete apostasy of the people of Judah. And I promise you today, it is more than enough to cover whatever you have done and whatever you are carrying. Because at the end of the day, it's not really about whether you're that broken. It's whether or not God is that good and loving and compassionate and faithful. Ann Voskamp writes, life can't be about being good enough, but instead believing there is God enough for whatever our own humanity needs grace for. Yeah, our mistakes can be big, but don't underestimate God. He's always bigger. Adonai Shema, the Lord is there. You know, as I've thought about the way that title is used in the Bible, there's a part of me that is tempted to want to go back and retranslate it, maybe a little less technically, but to try and capture what it feels like the fuller meaning of that word is in its context. And if I did that, I'd probably take a stab at it by saying this. Adonai Shema, the Lord who doesn't give up on you. The Lord who doesn't give up on you. Because over and over and over again, in spite of the ways in which we keep getting it wrong, God keeps showing up. He doesn't give up on you. He keeps being there for you with his restorative presence. May this truth be for our encouragement and hope today and cause us to marvel again at how amazing our God is. I want to invite you into a moment of silence and reflection. Maybe if you would, just close your eyes and bow your head. As we reflect and we attend to God's presence in our midst this morning and the work that he wants to do. And specifically, if you're here today and you're carrying something from your past that maybe makes you wonder in some way whether or not you've scared God off, or whether you've offended him one too many times, or maybe just once, but it's a pretty big mistake in your eyes. If you're here and you're wondering whether you've wrecked your relationship with God in some almost irreparable way, then my prayer is that in these next moments of silence that you would experience Adonai Shema, the God who meets you with his restorative presence, the God who has not given up on you. And so, Holy Spirit, I invite you to speak that truth into our hearts right now. Remind us again that you never despise a broken and contrite heart. Might those who worry that their sin has chased you away be assured in this moment of your forgiveness, your love, and your restorative presence. May it be as thick in their lives in this moment as it was in the tabernacle in that moment. Right now, God, might you set people free and give new hope. And so I invite you to speak to us, Holy Spirit.